Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
So this is what we contribute to the podcast. I will be diligent about watching the wardrobe choices of the administration and make sure that they're acting like adults.
I'm like pulling case law over here trying to understand what's going on.
Trying to defend people's free speech rights. It's a great balance, really.
That's what we're here for.
Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin, because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense. Hey, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Mercedes, and I'm here with my friend Rachel. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
And today we have a jam-packed episode. It seems like Tuesdays are typically pretty jam-packed. There's a lot going on. We're going to try and get through all of it. But before we do that, if this is your first time here, welcome. You have found your new favorite podcast. And we would recommend, or hopefully, if you would like, to avoid any advertisements and get some bonus content, you would consider becoming a paying supporter. Also, because you're going to like us so much, you should just go ahead and give us that 5-star rating. It should be like a done deal. I'm just letting you know. And if so, we very much appreciate it. Okay, so what are we talking about today? There's like
literally everything.
Honestly, not even, because there was like so much more. Okay. First off, we're going to be talking at the top with what is happening, giving you guys just a quick summary of what is happening in Syria.
A lot.
And it's horrible.
Yes.
The details are minimal just because of the region. And honestly, the media isn't really necessarily reporting on it so much.
If they are, it's very convoluted and watered down.
Yeah.
And we have no idea, like, we can't know that it's completely accurate either because of where
it's
coming
hard
out.
To decode on what's going on. Then we're also going to talk about some apparent alleged drama with Trump's cabinet, a little Act Blue drama. If you're not familiar with Act Blue, they are the major funding arm of the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. And then if we have time, which we're going to do our best to make the time, we need to talk about also what is happening in Colombia and the detainment of Mahmoud Kali, I think is how you pronounce it.
So it's not like in actual Columbia, but at Columbia University.
Yes.
Because I was like, what? Honestly, I was scared there for a moment. I'm like, something's happening in Columbia? What's happening in Columbia?
No.
I didn't go to bed that early.
No, Columbia University / Barnard.
Yeah.
So, and then of course we got some earmarks. So first, top of the hour.
Top of the ticket
is what is happening in Syria. Let me see if I can give you guys the very brief understanding of what is going on. Assad, who was, well, a terrifying dictator, his family was in power for what, like 50 years or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, it was a family enterprise in Syria.
Yeah,
yes.
It was like father, son. It went on for a while. Okay, obviously, dictator, horrible man, gassing his population in partnership. I think he was getting a lot of aid from Russia, the United States, of course. And this is a summation of like 50 years. Okay. I'm giving you a quick summation of 50 years.
This is not
this is not super accurate. Okay. Yes. Just asterisk. Okay. Because Russia was being involved, and of course, United States and Russia, proxy wars, Middle East, we saw this in Afghanistan, like in the 80s and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The US would send aid to rebels that were in the area. Now, they would say them as opposition rebels, but also sometimes they were just like other terrorist organizations. Yeah, right. Okay.
So, yes, we are complicit in that. There's no denying it.
Now, there are also other terrorist organizations, which is kind of like the one that is at the top of the ticket, that previously had been aided as in the past by the United States to help weaken Assad, but also currently are being aided by Turkey, which ironically is a NATO member.
Yeah,
let's put that out there.
Every single time that's brought up and we talk about their interactions and their allies and who they help and who they send money to. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, by the way, they sit on NATO. That's just still mind blowing.
Okay. But let's not get into NATO because we got into NATO last time. Okay. Yeah. Let's focus on one thing at a time.
Stay focused, Mercedes. We can do this.
So what was it in December? Was it last year that Assad was toppled?
January 2025. So, I mean, it was recent. It was earlier that it was toppled, but as of 2025, the new quote unquote president, who was not, I mean, it's not how we think of elections and somewhat a leader assuming the position of the head of a country. It's, it doesn't work like that there.
Yeah.
It's a little different.
It's not exactly on the up and up, but Assad goes down. The media, Democrats, everybody starts celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who kind of pointed out that this could actually be worse,
yeah,
was portrayed as
an Assad sympathist.
I don't think I said that because
sympathizer.
You messed me up,
guys. It's 6:19. Okay, sympathizer. Excuse me. I was doing apologist and sympathizer together, but yeah,
we can do that.
Our media really did kind of, I don't want to say carry water, but definitely push the narrative that Assad is the absolute worst situation for Syria and that.
Which he is Al-Julani, a bad situation.
Yes,
for
he
Syria.
Is a very bad situation. I think two things can exist at one time.
There's bad and then there's
and then
worse.
There's really
or
bad.
There's like
yeah.
worse and there's a worser, which isn't even a word, but you know what I mean?
It's a real thing there. Neither option's great. Neither option is even okay. Like there, it's both. It's just all bad. But our media definitely, we're pushing the narrative that Assad had to go. This dictator had to be toppled. And this more moderate leader, even if an interim president, which is what he's considered, Al-Julani, I think is how you say his name, was going to bring a more, I don't even know what they were thinking.
There was joy in the crowd headed for Friday prayers. 75% of Syrians are from the largest branch of Islam, the Sunnis. And the rebel leaders are Sunni fundamentalists. But no one knows yet how minority Muslim sects and Christians will be protected. The leader of the rebels is 42-year-old Ahmed al-Shara. In 2013, the U.S. named him a terrorist and later put a $10 million bounty on his head. But so far, al-Shara has kept order. There's little sign of destruction, looting, or reprisals, and government workers are on the job. The people do not know yet how they will be governed. Peace seems to be in the hearts of many, but the shooting hasn't stopped entirely. Israel last week grabbed the chance to bomb what's left of Syria's military. The U.S. is hitting remnants of ISIS terrorists in central Syria.
Well, it's the same thing that happened back during Obama with the Arab Spring, where everybody's this is going to be awesome, it's going to be great. But the problem is that a lot of times, or almost every time, I can't think of a single one, but you can correct me, where there is a vacuum in the Middle East, Islamic radical segment or segments, because there's usually more than one, will start to war with each other. And then I don't know, who's ever most horrible seems to rise to the top.
Right.
So that is kind of the general, really quick, not perfect summary of what has happened in Syria up until this weekend.
So just so we're clear, when you're reading news stories about this or listening to podcasts, different people can have different names for the current interim president. His name is Ahmad Hussein al-Shara, but he also can be known by his nom de guerre, Abu Muhammad al-Julani. And so if you hear Al-Julani or Al-Shara, they're talking about the same person. Assad was the past president, and his family was in a position of power in Syria for decades. So Al-Shara, that's what we'll call him, he was slash is in charge of the HTS, which Ms. Sadie and I are going to try and say today, but we might just say HTS. It stands for the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
Again, and that is the group that he leads and he oversees.
The rebel group that toppled the dictatorship.
The big issue, obviously, was being covered primarily on X over the weekend,
right,
was that this group is now seeking out religious minorities and torturing them and killing them. Yeah. Primarily the Alawite, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
And Christians and but the Druze also.
Yes.
Which are, I believe, closer to the Israeli side of Syria.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's a mess because not only do you have this entire long history of meddling, then Israel's also kind of been getting involved because once they saw that Assad was toppled, they were taking out weapons depots in the area, concerned that these groups like HTS would get a hold of them and then begin to use them in the region, because you don't typically want terrorist organizations to get their hands on weapons. Not a good idea. No. Kind of like, I don't know, kind of like what happened in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So that's currently what is happening there. What's really frustrating, because how do I say this? It's frustrating because it's like, everybody will try to pick a narrative. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when there's so many different hands in the pot, like the U.S. definitely meddled, Russians definitely meddled, Turkey's over there, Syria, Israel, like everybody's kind of like, a lot of people are almost having this argument online about who is responsible.
Right.
And for me, honestly, just to kind of simplify what is the biggest issue? The biggest issue is that there is a terrorist organization that has taken over Syria.
Like, well, Syria has been in a civil war since for 14 years now.
Yeah.
Okay. I think 2011, in the summer of 2011. So this isn't new. There's always been horrible, horrible conflict. And I was listening to someone who routinely has gone to Syria to report and actually just left a week and a half ago. So thank God. And he was talking about how the people there, I mean, the country is war-torn. And he said the people there just look like zombies. They're so exhausted from fear and anxiety and constant turbulation and tumult all the time since 2011. So this isn't new for the people there. It's horrible. And then you have people on X who live in America, who we all live these very, very comfortable lives, trying to make heads or tails of constant terrorism happening to a people. And then diagnosing it. So you have a lot of people saying, well, Assad, Christians were safe under Assad, and the Alawites were safe under Assad because he was a member of that sect. And it's like, no, not exactly. Have you been reading the news about Syria the last 12 years? People weren't safe. Christians were killed. They were imprisoned. These were not good guys that were there. But then the narrative was pushed. He had to go, and now someone else is coming in. And there's even more, there's an uptick all of a sudden in this horrific violence, and the media seems to be, well, they were not reporting on it really at all. And then it was like tacitly, it was like, yes, there's conflict happening there again. It's, well, let's get a little more specific. And it's almost like they feel that they'll just say like minority groups. They don't really, it's like you have to push them to say actually what's happening. Like, just be honest. And I don't know if that's in an abundance of caution that they want to get the facts right. I'd love to think that about the media, but I know better.
It's because it's
hard for them to admit that there's Christians being persecuted anywhere in the world, or that then they would have to say this is a Muslim-backed resistance that is terrorist-funded and terrorist-run. That's really hard for them to say out loud. And I think that that makes it even harder for people to have a clear idea of what's happening.
Well, the media has definitely been kind of soft-pedaling the reporting, which is interesting after they were lauding the fall of Assad and then saying this moderate was coming into power. However, the administration, the State Department, did put out a statement specifically condemning the violence against the religious minorities and urging like an immediate halt to the persecution. challenge here is that I don't know what we would expect from this administration currently, considering that they're in the process of avoiding conflict or
De-escalating everywhere.
Yeah. They want to de-escalate. They want to focus on America first. They don't want to engage in any other conflict, especially with the concerns that when you start funding rebels in the area, you're not 100% sure exactly where this money's going to go, how it's going to be used. There are people that I think are more trustworthy, obviously, like the Druze, Israel in the area. They're, I think, more trustworthy than what's happening in the past. But I honestly don't know what this administration is going to do. I don't know if they're going to be offering any kind of asylum. Even if you give them asylum, I don't know how you get them out of Syria.
Right.
Like, it's just a really, really difficult situation. And the most I can say right now is be aware that it's happening and pray for those who are being harmed in this conflict.
Yeah. And I think it serves every single one of these times that something like this happened. It serves as a poignant reminder for us Americans who like to complain on a variety of levels, myself included, just that, oh my gosh, get the bunker ready. Life's the worst. And it's really, we have no idea. And there are people all over our world who are afflicted and terrorized and persecuted for their religion. And we just live in such an amazing country where so far and right now, we're able to worship peacefully.
As we please. Yeah.
Yes. And live peacefully for the most part. And we have very little idea so far, like I said, of what true oppression feels like. So let's think about that the next time a 19-year-old says that they're oppressed for their life choices. It's like, you have no idea. We have no idea. So keep them in your prayers and spread the news so that your communities can be praying for them as well.
Absolutely. So we're going to do a little sharp turn, which is always the struggle when you're doing this type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So we got a little bit of drama in the White House, apparently, over the weekend. I think it happened on Friday.
Oh. Is it drama?
Look, that is what we're trying to be sold, okay? Yeah. I am simply trying to project the narrative that is acceptable far and wide so then we can pick it apart, okay? So over, I think it was on Friday, there was like an emergency cabinet meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Times put out this article that had some, I guess, like, 5 minions that were lurking around the White House that were able to give some insider information on this cabinet meeting. So I think everybody, like the entire cabinet was there. And I think the only one that wasn't there was Bessette, which is Treasury. But the big focus of this cabinet meeting had 4 players, obviously, President Trump, Elon Musk, Marco Rubio, and Sean Duffy.
Okay.
They were like the stars of this article. Okay.
Why would Sean Duffy be there? Just because of... Because
he's...
Well, I know the Secretary of Transportation, but I know that. It's like he just sauntered in. He's, I'm here for the meeting. No, I just mean specifically, were they talking about... Did I miss where you said that they were talking about something transportation related?
No, it was an entire cabinet meeting. Like,
okay, I thought you said there was only a few of them there. You're talking about the blow up.
The blow up only, like the focus is these 4 individuals.
Okay, 6:34 a.m.
Like, I'm sorry when I said that, but it was an entire cabinet
meeting. I'm sure you did.
Only person that wasn't there was Scott Bessett, right? Okay. Treasury.
Like, oh, and your favorite. You like him a lot, don't you? No, you like Lutnick.
I like Lutnick. Yeah. Yeah. Just I find him entertaining. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know the man personally, but I like to watch him. Like, yeah. It's funny. So anyways, claim is that Musk, and this apparently was primarily focused around the Doge cuts and what is Doge doing. So Musk has had, obviously, a pretty aggressive forward approach about the cuts. I mean, we saw him at CPAC with the chainsaw and everything. And now the claim is, these are the reports, that Musk was criticizing Rubio and claimed that he had not fired anybody. Like, you're not firing nobody or whatever, right?
Okay, yeah.
Rubio counters, mentioning that he has had layoffs via the retirements. And also, I think there were, like, the buyouts. And then Musk took a jab at him and said, basically, well, you're just good on TV, but you're not effective. Okay.
Oh.
Which, isn't that nice? Okay.
It's not nice.
It's not nice. Okay. The picture is, if you read this New York Times article, they tell it like a story. It's actually a really good article if you want to get like an entire narrative, because they're talking about like how they're yelling at each other across the table. Trump is sitting back with his arms crossed, which I absolutely can picture. And lots of drama, primarily between Musk and Rubio. There's also been a rising narrative in the media that I've noticed that Rubio is getting sidelined and Musk is taking over, and Rubio doesn't like how Musk is kind of dominating and forcing cuts and making things difficult. And so that Rubio was the one that's like most speaking about it. Then also, in addition to that, there was another conflict where Musk accused, no, I'm sorry, Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, said that Doge's people were trying to fire air traffic controllers. Musk said that's not happening. There was a big debate about that. Anyways, this entire quote unquote blow up.
Well, real quick, was according to the report, was Trump there the whole time during this entire thing, just watching it?
The entire thing. Yeah. Just sitting back.
I mean, he does that. It's kind of what he did with Zelensky and JD Vance when he just let him talk.
Yeah.
And he's watching it.
Exactly. And he's watching just watching the whole thing. It seems the, honestly, so the New York Times, like I said, I would recommend that you read the article if you have a subscription, because it is an actually quite engaging narrative, right?
Ooh, Sadie likes a good fight.
Yeah, I appreciate a good fight. Now, I was actually reading this article out loud to my husband while we were driving up to camp over the weekend.
You can drive and read at the same time?
He's the same way. He's like, I can't drive and read at the same time.
Well, obviously.
I
get a good, we'll get in the car to go on a date night. I'm like, I got to do a little work before we get there. And I start like typing, putting on a comment or caption. And that's
zero motion sickness.
Man, oh, to be you.
Yeah. So anyways, I read the entire article to him. Now, I've mentioned before, my husband, his job is this executive C-level job. So he has been in meetings where you have multiple strong personalities, primarily male, who are debating what's going to happen next in a business or what's going on.
Yeah. Bunch of alphas kind of sitting around.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I read this article to him. And now, granted, my husband is a supporter of the administration, but one of the things that he pointed out to me was, well, this seems like just a bunch of strong personalities hashing out, and this is what happens a lot of times. He's like, I've had this same experience in a board meeting multiple times.
Yeah.
However, the New York Times, of course, is trying to present this as a narrative that there are fractions happening within the administration.
Well, I think that they would love it if there's a bunch of cracks in the foundation. I think that they would think that nothing would delight them more, I'm sure. But I think, like most guys, like your husband, like, yeah, this happened. I mean, I have sat back here where I share a desk with my husband and listened to him verbally spar on a conference call. And then at the end, they're like, okay,
bye.
Talk to you on Thursday. Like, this is normal. And so it actually makes me think that the people at New York Times are weird. Like, they're so squishy and soft that they can't handle like a full-throated, bold
like
conversation.
Debate?
Yeah, with someone else. Like, you can't argue with someone and then be okay. I've been there many times and I'm not an alpha male. So I don't know. Makes me kind of go, do you guys not talk at New York Times? Do you guys not have disagreements or?
I don't know. I mean, let's be honest. For the last how many years, especially with Democrats, like, you know, what that's one of the issues actually with the Democrat Party is that they all just kind of like agree with each other and placate one another and don't necessarily want to create friction because.
Yeah, they used to be the party of diversity and how everybody was different and you could not align completely with someone else, but be within the same party. And now it's just very monochromatic. Like they're all kind of the same. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's the New York Times problem.
There was another one also that got pulled into it, Collins, because there was concerns because he's with Veteran Affairs, which is a huge voting block for the administration. And that, you know, just he's just taking people out and eliminating them without knowing who's actually good and who's bad is a problem.
Yeah.
So in response, it looked like in response to this meeting, Trump came out and the goals appear to have shifted a little bit. So we've been having a season of the chainsaw, right?
Yes, definitely. The gold chainsaw, which we all know my feelings about the chainsaw.
If you weren't here in a previous episode, that was a chainsaw gifted to Elon by Argentina's president, Milei, which he wielded on the stage at CPAC. Anyways, at this point, we've been having a little season of just chainsaw cutting. And then after this meeting, Trump put out a statement where he was like, we're going to shift over essentially to the scalpel. We're going to be much more cautious and purposeful of the cuts that we are making. I'm sure that is in response to pressure that he's been getting from Republicans. He's being aware of what's going on. I'm sure also from his cabinet. His cabinet is probably at this point, look, we've made a bunch of cuts. We've made indiscriminate cuts. We now need to slow down because I want to make sure that I keep my quality people, which was basically what Collins from the VA secretary, director, I can't remember, was pointing
out. Well, and then Marco Rubio released a statement about USAID that they did a lot of cuts and that
86%.
And the existing percentage that is still alive and well and funding things is going to shift over under the umbrella of the State Department. And then you had a bunch of press on Air Force One asking Trump, and basically he squashed any rumors.
Mr. President, you have said there's no feud between your cabinet members and Elon Musk. Yeah. You even had dinner with him last night, the Secretary revealed. However, tensions are high. And between your cabinet and Mr. Musk, how are you
going to
simmer down tensions? Does Mr. Musk need to back off?
Well, I don't think the tensions are high. Look, Elon's a very special person, and these cabinet people are special people. You know, these are very successful people, or they wouldn't have gotten, you know, they've attained the highest heights of government. And they, I think they have fantastic relationship to Elon. And Doge has been incredible. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars of waste and fraud and abuse has been found, already found. And that doesn't mean they don't have a little bit of an argument here and there about something, or maybe personal arguments. There's not too many contract arguments. You know, contracts have been found. This is much more than just personnel. We found hundreds of billions of dollars of fraudulent contracts or very wasteful, but I think fraud. I think it's fraud.
There was just another plane crash.
And I think really the cabinet, for the most part, I think they get along really well with Elon.
There was just another.
And I think he was also asked about it in the Oval, too.
Yeah, like, and he was right like, before. No, there was nothing. Like, calm down, you guys.
No, Clash, I was there. You're just a troublemaker. And you're not supposed to be asking that question because we're talking about the World Cup. Elon gets along great with Marco, and they're both doing a fantastic job. There is no clash.
Mr. President,
who are you with? Who are you with?
NBC.
Oh, no wonder. That's enough. NBC.
Who has more authority, Elon Musk or the Secretary?
Any other questions?
Like, I think that this is probably very standard for the business world. It happens all the time. And so Trump's like, why are you whining, babies? Just handle
the
conversation.
And I think that's the other thing, how like this administration is just very different. And I think it's a challenge maybe in reporting like how they function, because this isn't your typical bureaucratic government run administration. No. We have, not only is the president a businessman, but there are several businessmen who are in the cabinet. Not all of them. There's government. I mean, Noam was governor. Duffy, I think he was an attorney, but he also ran for office and he was a representative for a while. There is a mix there, but there are definitely a lot of independent
mindsets.
Well, you know, and they're going to bump heads.
I can see someone like Rubio. He's a little more conventional, a little more political.
Yeah.
I can see him getting more irritated with, hey guys, there's a way you do things around here. I can see that for sure. I mean, he's a little more, and I love him for it. He's a little bit more straight-laced, a little more tightly wound. And if he's seen, I think he's reading tea leaves. Like, if it continues and Musk is overstepping in some way that he feels, I'm sure he's going to speak out. Mr. President, what we're doing is good, but we don't want to tarnish it by not being careful. You know,
I'm sure Musk is frustrated with the fact that he has to be working within the parameters of a federal government that moves at a snail's pace. And at this point, even though it's moving fast in comparison to past administrations, I'm sure for him, it's moving really slow. So I completely expect there to be these types of tensions, but I don't necessarily think that it's to the point that the media is trying to project it to be.
Which is the case with a lot of different things.
The source to this story, or like five individuals.
Is it anonymous?
Yes.
Is it all anonymous? Of course.
So we don't even know. Are they getting the drama, the narrative secondhand?
It's
Were
always
they in
anonymous.
The room? Is it like the assistant of an assistant that's like deciding to? We have no idea.
Yeah.
Nobody's named. So we don't know. Even maybe it's a cabinet member. We have no freaking idea. You know what I mean? But the point is that it's really hard to, again, verify these things or give it weight when you don't necessarily know who's talking about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So, now, I want to talk about some other drama that's also been happening.
Let us do that.
And that is with the Democrats' fundraising arm, Act Blue.
Yep. I mean, it's been a mess for a while now, but it's really hitting some hard times.
Okay, so Act Blue, if you are unfamiliar, is a major Democrat fundraising platform. It is like the fundraising platform.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they have funds that they distribute to Democrats. They organize. They provide that platform. Every time you go to a Democrat's website or any kind of progressive organization's website and you click this donor button, mm-hmm. if you look at the fine print, it's mostly being handled by Act Blue. Okay. So the money goes through them, then they send it out, they charge a processing fee. That's how Act Blue makes their money.
And now, in the last 6 months, they're everywhere, but people don't disclose it. Like different people, I'm trying to think of what was that latest example where?
So what happened was it was Gavin Newsom. And it wasn't that they don't disclose it. They do disclose it in the fine print.
In the fine print, but they don't, I mean, come on.
It's not like obvious. It's like when Gavin Newsom, he launched a website to combat misinformation about the Palisade fires. And then within that, you could donate to help aid with the Palisades. And I think also Pod Save America did the same thing.
Yes.
But then the processing platform to do that was Act Blue. And it was a concern because Act Blue is a fund for political purposes to fund Democrats, right?
Yeah.
And so everybody was like, are these donations actually going to the Palisades? Mm-hmm. Does Act Blue or do the Democrats decide who are the organizations that are going to get this money to help the Palisades? Is Act Blue waiving their processing fee? There was just like a lot of questions. So that was kind of one of the things that brought it to attention recently. Mm-hmm. However, they've long had controversies, specifically where it comes to frequent small dollar donations, because these small dollar donations are coming up from the same individuals. We're talking about like $10, $15, but it's multiple payments, like sometimes in the hundreds, where just like almost like an auto draft situation. Yeah. But then there was a while back where James O'Keefe was investigating this and he went and visited and asked elderly donors who were listed as donors to Act Blue for giving these $10, $15 donations that ended up totaling thousands of dollars, asking them, did you make these donations? And they're like, no, I never made this donation.
FEC data shows that some senior citizens across the U.S. have been donating thousands of times per year. Some of these individuals' names and addresses are attached to over $200,000 in contributions. We went and knocked on a few of their doors to corroborate the data that we received.
We're wondering if these donors are victims of what appears to be a money laundering scheme.
Cindy Noe of Annapolis, Maryland, who in the year 2022 allegedly contributed over 1,000 times to Act Blue, totaling $18,849.77. That means Cindy would have had to donate three times a day, every day for the whole year.
My name's James O'Keefe, and we're doing a story on the number of people that have donated. You did donate to Act Blue, right?
Once in a while.
What about $18,850?
No, I don't think so.
You know people are using your address?
I don't think so.
So the question is, what is Act Blue doing? Where are these small donor donations coming from?
Mm-hmm.
The speculation is that it's some kind of laundering process where they maybe offshore, or maybe they receive funds and then somebody has it and they start depositing it into Act Blue through small dollar donations. This is the speculation, okay? I'm not making any claims. There's no evidence. Nobody has been proved of any wrongdoing. But
a bunch of people resigned in February of 2025.
Well,
seven,
not only that,
senior executives.
So as soon as funds started to get cut to all of these Democrat projects, Act Blue is one of these organizations that started to dry up. Now, they could be drying up because we are post-election.
Yeah.
People don't want to be donating to them because they're the losing party.
And they don't see a need right now. They'll wait until midterms if they're going to do that.
Yes. However, what is interesting is that, like you said, there were seven key figures that just suddenly resigned. And they're not figures that were
hired like a year ago. These people have been there for over a decade.
And then they just like suddenly like bolt. And then so the spokesperson's claiming that these resignations are part of the routine transition of a new election cycle.
Well, if they were, they would have resigned before, but they didn't. They've been there for a decade.
So not only that, but I looked into it. And yeah, so there are typically resignations where people like, I don't want to say underlings, but staff switch out. They end up working for the administration or they go work for some Democrat group or something like that, right? That often happens. But for this level, like you said, some of them have been there for a decade. So mm-hmm. to have like seven members just up and leave all of a sudden.
That's interesting.
Is a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I don't know if anybody's done anything wrong, but it is worth mentioning. This stuff is weird. Mm-hmm. And it's been weird for a while. And it likely wasn't really investigated because this is a Democrat donation arm. The Democrats were in power. Yeah. And so they're not going to go
do an investigation and on do their an investigation own people.
And who's
funding all of their different campaigns.
And this isn't like the first time this has come up. There were like multiple states, like 19 attorney generals. Now they were from Republican states, but they've been investigating the potential fraud and illegal contributions because mm-hmm. it's just like by doing all these small dollar donations, the challenge here is that you don't have to provide as much reporting. And then it also would kind of contribute to the narrative where Democrats have always been, we're the biggest in small dollar donations, and that most of our donations,
a narrative for them. Like,
exactly,
we're here for the little people, the working man who can't contribute 5,000 but can contribute 25. And you hear that talking point from Democrat, especially presidential candidates, when they're on the campaign trail, when it's like, my campaign had the most.
Yeah,
Obama famously ran on that. Like, my campaign had the most small dollar donations of any campaign in United States history. We are a grassroots effort. We're here for every American, not just the wealthy billionaires. It fits a narrative.
Well, it's just kind of funny if you really think about it, because Democrats, just in their nature, centralize things. Mm-hmm. Now, centralizing things is great for kind of like efficiency purposes. Do you know what I mean? However, it's a problem when you put all your eggs in one basket and then that basket explodes.
Yeah, seriously. Then what are you going to do?
You know what I mean?
Right, like, now, they can't concentrate on anything else. They need to find a leader and a cohesive message. This is another problem that has been identified that the Democrats are going to have to clean up real quick before midterms because they're floundering. They don't have a key message.
Well, and it's not like just the resignation of those seven individuals. I forgot to mention that they have a union. And so the union themselves are like, this is really like a problem. It's creating issues with morale. But then there was also Zayn Ahmad, which is a lawyer and general counsel for Act Blue, came into the office and was blocked from their email because he had been pushing, or he wanted to bring attention about the importance of Act Blue's whistleblower policies. Mm-hmm. This is my speculation. My thought is that like somebody was trying to come forward, say something's going on with Act Blue, and then they were getting some pushback. And then their legal counsel here had to point out like, look, we have whistleblower policies that we need to respect. Mm-hmm. So they ended up going and getting pushed out of their email and essentially pushed out of Act Blue.
Yes, I think eventually things are going to come out about what's actually happening. For right now, this is just leaving the Democrats scrambling, and they're already like, it's sad. They're scrambling as it is.
The question is, will they be investigated? And it's just really frustrating because this is a huge fundraising arm for the Democrats. And so obviously anything that happens with this administration investigating Act Blue is going to be portrayed, or the narrative is going to be attempted, that this is just, again, them going after their political opponents.
Mm-hmm.
When, just so you guys know, Act Blue has long had some suspicious speculation, even during previous administrations, that something's not on the up and up.
They're going to have to get another fundraising arm together before
that's the other thing.
The midterms. Like, they're going to have to organize something. They got a lot of plates that are spinning right now.
They actually had a little meeting where Hakeem, like, it was like this kind of like social media campaign strategy mm-hmm. meeting where Hakeem Jeffries was in it and a bunch of other like digital leaders mm-hmm. were talking about what their messaging was going to be, what's going to be next.
Yeah.
I watched a segment of it, believe it or not. It was a mess.
Yeah. Because all of them have competing ideas for what's important. There's no one clear defined leader. Hakeem Jeffries isn't.
No.
Like we said on last, I think it was the last podcast, he's no Nancy Pelosi. Like, he can't wrangle all those cats. It's just not in him. It's just a mess. There's no direction. And there are already speculations on, I think it was the WAPO or New York Times on their socials this week, projecting their ideas for who the 8 possible presidential runs are for 2028. And it's just the same.
It's the same people.
Bag joke of jokers. Like, you got Kamala Harris, Josh Shapiro.
Well, Gavin Newsom is trying to rebrand himself.
Gavin Newsom, of course. Yes. It was just the same old, same olds. I'm like, you guys, Pete Buttigieg. I'm like, none of this is working for you.
Did you happen to listen to Gavin Newsom's new podcast where he sat down with Charlie Kirk?
I listened to some of it. I've listened to Gavin Newsom my whole life. I mean, he was the governor yeah. there while we lived there. And I just don't like him. And I mean, he was a horrible governor. So I have contempt and bitterness. But I just think it's funny how he's, I wrote in my stories after I listened to some of it, I'm like, this guy's running to the center. Like, he's trying to agree with Charlie Kirk about the trans issue and boys and girls sports, whatnot. I'm like, he's running. And I said that in stories. And tons of people I know in California were like, no, it couldn't happen. I'm like, where
are you?
What? Like, are you joking me right now? You guys tried to recall him unsuccessfully. This man is going to be forever in politics. He's going to be a Nancy Pelosi, a Mitch McConnell. Like, he's Chuck Schumer. He's going to be there forever. And you're darn right he's trying to run as a moderate left of center Democrat. And he has a full 3 years to rebrand himself. And we all know America has a very, very short memory.
Yeah, this isn't a Kamala Harris situation where she like rebrands herself in a week. Yeah.
Okay. No, they said that she's going to make an announcement by summertime if she's running for governor. I mean, I won't even know what world we're living in. If she wins the governorship of California, move out. Get out of there, you guys. I don't understand. The ship is sinking.
Away.
Anyways.
So let's move on to our final story, which has been, I don't know, it's just fat. Like, if you guys are not, I know a lot of people that follow me on my Instagram are not on X, and because they are constantly like, I appreciate that you share what's on X so I don't have to be on there.
Yeah.
Because the things that bubble up to the surface and the narratives that start to at least appear in my feed, mm-hmm. is fascinating to me sometimes. Yeah. Okay, so there was remember last year where Colombia was having a lot of tent encampments in protest of Israel that were pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas encampments or protests, right? Now, right. They took over buildings. They caused a bunch of damage.
They obstructed Jewish students from even just like walking on campus, let alone making it to their classes. There was violence. There was threatening signs, there's threatening chants, there was just blatant threats. This wasn't a protest. This was, I mean, they want to call it just a protest, but it was not. And they had like student negotiators. Anyways, I'm going to start getting riled up. Take it, Mercedes.
So that was last year. And it was really, and honestly, what was ironic was it was just around graduation where some of the universities ended up canceling their graduation ceremonies.
Well, yeah, because the students are kind of like babies. They're like, oh, it's so cold in December and January. But they came out for spring. They were like, OK, it's spring. It's a little bit warmer here on the East Coast. Now we can get in our tents and have you order Grubhub for us. And we can sit around and yell into microphones about our oppression.
Well, and then there was also like, I don't remember which university it was, but they had like Jewish students trapped in libraries while pounding on the
glass. It was all of them. NYU,
like
Barnard, Columbia,
yeah.
Emerson. I mean, it was a lot. Yale had every
Ivy
There was
League.
Ones in New Mexico, UCLA, USC. It was all kinds of. And it did start after October 7th, but it really escalated after the winter last year, where
yeah.
it was just like,
it was right up
it
against
was March, April, May, right up against graduation
where some graduations were canceled.
Yeah.
And then we also had the hearings with the presidents of the universities where Claudine Gray, is that
Gray.
Her name?
Mm-hmm.
That, and she ended up losing her job. Anyways, that was what happened last year. Now, there were some students that faced some disciplinary measures recently. And because of that, these protests bubbled up again. And recently they were predominantly in Barnard. Now, so you know, Barnard University is the women's liberal arts university that is affiliated with Columbia. Okay. So they're like, they're close, they're friends. Okay. Now, in the process of these protests, again, these students have taken over a library. They've been distributing like anti-Israel, actually, in fact, straight up Hamas pamphlets.
Yeah, promoting violence against Jews and quote unquote Zionists. Yeah.
Anti-Semitic graffiti, sabotage, damage. These aren't like peaceful protests is the goal.
They weren't last year either.
No. And this isn't like some peaceful anti-war protests where they're like, put an end to war or don't. Nope. Like, I could totally, that's fine. I have no problem with people protesting the war, protesting what's happening in Gaza, specifically because they don't think people should be bombing Gaza. But that is not the nature of these protests. The nature of these protests is
violence against Jews.
It's anti-Semitism, violence against Jews, distributing Hamas propaganda pamphlets, justifying the terrorism, and calling for the elimination of Israel. Okay. That's like it. That is the core tenet of these. Like, if you were to go like every protest, it's like, what is your goal? What is it that you want to accomplish?
Yeah.
It's violence to get rid of
Jews. Yeah. And they started last year. They tried. They were like, what's, if you would have asked them last year, what is your goal? Last school year, last academic year, what is your goal? It would have been a very much the mantra, the, we want to stop a genocide in Gaza. We want a two-state solution. They've dropped that. That's gone now. They do not want a two-state solution. That's probably the only thing that we all agree on, that that's not really going to work. But they've dropped all of that. Now just, we want to eliminate the Zionist state, which means we want to eliminate all the
Israel.
Jews. Very easy to understand. They're making it very clear.
So in the process of all of these protests happening at Barnard, Trump signed an executive order that was about anti-Semitism. And then he also put out a statement where he threatened Columbia to revoke $40 million of federal funding if they didn't get their act together in regards to anti-Semitism. And $400 million.
Yes.
In federal
funding.
That's
a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, especially if they're very, like, they're
very
dependent on it.
And they say things like that. I'm like, why? Why do you get that from the, again, see, here we go. Why doesn't Doge check into that? And all the different universities that are getting federal funding.
Well, they're not getting it right now because they ultimately did get a freeze, which then has, of course, Columbia reacting. Now, here's the deal. Trump's statement, this was like the challenge for me. I'll confess, for me, I don't like what's happening with these protests. I think these protests are not protests. I think they're gross.
And anti-America and
anti-terrorism.
They're pro-terrorism is what they are.
So now a lot of people were getting upset because when he put out that statement about illegal protests, this is typical Trump, very simple language. Mm-hmm. He didn't specify what qualifies an illegal protest. He doesn't go in and say that the destruction of property and blocking students and terrorizing Jewish students is illegal. He just goes and he says illegal protests. Mm-hmm. So that created a debate of, well, what is an illegal protest? This is the administration's attack on free speech. Mm-hmm. That is the debate that has been happening recently. Now, on top of that, the Department of Homeland Security has recently detained he's not a student anymore. He actually graduated, but he's
like the protest organizer, like the big dog who was organizing everything. He did graduate from Columbia.
Yes.
But he has been kind of working to organize all these protests. And then I heard he was also the mediator in some of these student to administration discussions, which I think is hilarious. When I hear that, I'm like, that's hilarious that they're having these discussions with these children. I mean, not all of them are children, but they're acting like children, that they're having these, let's all come to the table and come to some sort of agreement. But
he's been the lead organizer and he's been the lead mediator. His name is Muhad Khalid. And I'm probably mispronouncing that. But he is a Syrian national that is here in the United States. He was initially on a student visa and then also a green card holder. Okay. So he was detained by ICE March 8th what he is being detained for is his support of a terrorist organization such as Hamas, because he was seen, or at least this is what is being reported, that he was passing out, him along with the group that he was organizing, was passing out Hamas pamphlets. And I'm not even talking about these were pamphlets created by students that are like telling you that Hamas are rebel fighters or anything like that.
No, these were actually from Hamas, the terrorist organization.
With terrorists like on the front, like glorifying mm-hmm. what happened in October 7th as, I don't even remember the language that they used, but it was like, oh my gosh, I can't, but there was specific language in regards that this was a justified revolt or mm-hmm. defense of Gaza. Mm-hmm. Mind you, just a little bit of reminder that they jumped the fence and murdered children and raped yeah. women mm-hmm. and took hostages that they still have hostage.
Yeah.
Now, here's where the deal comes in, okay? The debate that is currently happening is not only is this a free speech issue mm-hmm. and was this just the practice of free speech on behalf of just, not just the students, but Khalid, but there's a big debate going on about the justification of his detainment mm-hmm. and taking his visa and his green card. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people are trying to make the argument that it's a First Amendment issue. And so because it's freedom of speech, he shouldn't be arrested. He can't be detained. There's also a lot of narrative that is being pushed about how he's apparently married. His wife is an American citizen. She is 8 months pregnant. And DHS went to his home and detained him. And the reports are that he is in a Louisiana detainment facility. Mm-hmm. Initially, they thought it was New Jersey. Now he's in Louisiana. I am going to be completely honest with you, because anything that can remotely come into question in regards to freedom of speech and mm-hmm. a lack of due process makes me very uncomfortable. I don't care who you are. And so I was like really focused on digging in to see what did this man actually do? Mm-hmm. Like, how has he contributed? What has he said? What mm-hmm. has justified his detainment? And it looks like the revocation of his visa and his
green card.
Mm-hmm. The challenge here is that there's like a lot of debate going on about rights. Mm-hmm. So if you are a U.S. citizen, and even if you are someone who is in the country, there are rights that just apply to everybody. So, for example, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the sort of things that are just like inherent rights that we all have. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, if you are not a citizen, you can't go vote. You can't, or you shouldn't. But, you know, mm-hmm. anyways, that's a whole other discussion. So those are things that are like actions. Mm-hmm. Those, they don't have rights. But the argument of like due process and freedom of speech and freedom of religion would apply mm-hmm. to this individual. The issue here is what doesn't apply is inciting violence. What right. doesn't apply also, especially when you have a green card and you're here as a visitor, is the support of a terrorist organization. Like right. it specifically states in the immigration law mm-hmm. that if you are a supporter of a terrorist organization, that you can end up, it merits a detainment and deportation.
Yep. Sounds pretty cut and dry.
Now, I was like, I was actually having this discussion with my husband. I was like, can the government just like unilaterally decide? Because he hasn't been found guilty of anything. And that was the thing, that he hasn't been like charged, arrested, found guilty of anything. He wasn't expelled from the school. Like the school was investigating him and they wanted to suspend him. And then that was overturned. So there was like no charge on him currently, mm-hmm. like criminal or anything like that. It's not like he was charged with causing damage or, I don't know, breaking into a building or anything like yeah. that. However, I was looking at the jurisdiction of this, and it turns out that the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, immigration specifically, are the ones who have jurisdiction over immigration issues, which the green card and the visa fall under immigration. And then there are judges that are under the executive branch mm-hmm. with the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice. So this isn't, I'm specifying that this isn't the judicial branch. This is yeah. specifically under the executive branch.
Okay. Yeah.
And these immigration judges are then the ones who determine and adjudicate whether or not the detainment and the revocation of his green card and his visa is justified.
Okay.
And in the meantime, the law enforcement arm, which is ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, has the right to hold him.
Yeah.
Which is what they're doing right now. They're detaining him.
Yeah.
So this entire narrative of all of this being, which, and I looked into this because it made me uncomfortable. I'm like, can you just like snatch a person off the street? Because that's what the narrative is. He's been snatched off the street without any due process and is being arrested and his green card and visa are being revoked.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily what's happened yet. He is in detainment and he still needs to go through the adjudication process where an administrative judge will determine where he will get an opportunity to defend whether or not he should lose his green card or his visa.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like where we stand right now.
Well, and Marco Rubio made a statement. I don't know if we have the video, but it was very cut and dry to him. He was basically like, if you hold a visa or a green card and you support a terrorist organization, you'll be deported. I just think it's difficult right now for Americans to unpack because this hasn't happened routinely. This is a new horizon that we're having to deal with in America. And it makes people uncomfortable at first because our idea of First Amendment rights are so all encompassing. But like you said, when you read further into it, this is an ability that the administration has.
And let's be honest, there is an agreement when an individual comes here on a visa and a green card, they enter essentially an agreement with the U.S. government that right. I'm going to follow these rules and I'm going to behave in X, Y way.
Yeah.
And if I don't, then you have the right to revoke my visa or my green card. And that is kind of where we are right now.
Yeah.
Of course, my challenge here, or you always, like we talk about how optics
matter.
Mm-hmm. And the challenge here is, what are the optics of this? You know what I mean? And who is going to receive it? Now, the Democrats, or I shouldn't say the Democrats, partially it's the Democrats, and like the progressive wing of the left are the loudest. Even though they're necessarily the smallest, they're the loudest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they are pushing, they got the narrative out there. Is it unfortunate that this man has a wife that's 8 months pregnant and is now alone in her home?
Yeah.
Worried about what's going on with her husband. Of course. Yep. Of course.
But, I mean, there's a lot of unfortunate things that are happening to a lot of people, but actions have consequences. So
I don't like, you know, it's again, kind of like an emotional manipulation or trying to create.
Well, and most people don't want to do the work you did. They want to hear a soundbite and just roll with that, especially if it fits their preferred narrative of, oh, this man's free speech rights are being infringed upon, instead of just digging a little bit deeper and going, well, it's not that simple. So,
well, and it definitely, like, my point to this is that because it was really making me uncomfortable.
Yeah, it makes people feel queasy, but that's why you go and do extra work like you did.
Now, I don't even know necessarily if, because the detainment issue, do you know what I mean? I do get detaining him in the sense of he could disappear into the United States.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe they have some kind of credible threat surrounding him and that we don't know about yet. We have no idea.
Yeah, but he will. I mean, he is going to have to go before a judge. He will get an opportunity to make his case. We don't know whether or not, the question is that will be debated is this a free speech issue? Can he be detained if he hasn't really been found criminally liable or having participated in any kind of criminal act?
I just think it's funny. And this is a whole, we could talk forever about this. I just think it's so interesting to me that a majority of the media and a political party that just really majored on January 6th and the destruction of property and the entering into buildings,
they don't want to talk about
lawfully. They just are giving a free pass, or not even just a free pass, but like a pat on the shoulder, like, you bad college students shouldn't have done that, when full wings of libraries and dorms and buildings that are storied and beautiful are destroyed by a bunch of petulant students, and they just kind of give it a free pass. Like, what happened to property rights? What happened to not, it's early. What's the word? When you're making it impossible for another student to go somewhere. If it wasn't right on January 6th, then it isn't right here. And I don't, maybe because it's like a private property, because it's Colombia's property, then it doesn't hold the same weight. It was the U.S. Capitol. It's a much bigger deal, whatever. I'm just saying it's very interesting to me that there's so little discussion by the legacy media and by Democrats about the actual damage that these students have done on multiple campuses. It's not just Columbia. It was happening all over the country where there were students, like you said, total sabotage, like pouring concrete into the sewage lines.
Yeah.
Or absolutely like breaking in and breaking down doors and windows and glass to get into.
Well, and then the challenge here is too that some of them aren't necessarily even students. You know what I mean?
Where's the outrage with that? Because all I heard all last year was these students just, this is the sound of the resistance. This is just students that need to be heard. And it's, well, okay. But again, that's just only applied one way. It just seems disingenuous to me.
Well, and unfortunately, this entire situation, especially with his detainment, is going to be used as a political ploy, honestly, on both sides. So yeah. You're going to have the progressives using it as a type of, I don't know, like martyr, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He's going to be like an image of the resistance, the administration's attack on free speech. However, I don't 100% know how effective that's going to be, because the normies of who is the majority of Americans, mm-hmm. remember the protests on 2020. Do you know what I mean? They remember what happened last year after October 7th. And the reactions from the most progressive wing of the left. They remember these encampments. They remember the damage that's been happening.
Well, they don't have time for it because they don't have a lot of the people, like you said, the normies, they're dealing with the meat and potato issues, like affording groceries and inflation and being able to afford rent. And then they're watching on television a bunch of these babies out there with their Stanley cups in their tents demanding food and sanitary products and like sleeping bags. And they're like, it's totally unrelatable to them. And then they're destroying property and, oh, boo-hoo, now you're crying about it. I just don't think it's going to hit the nerve of
what they're hoping for.
No, not at all.
So I don't know. And the administration has also said that he is not going to be the first. So my question is, what does that mean? How many
more Mercedes is going to become a what's the word? A detainment spokesperson. She's going to tell us. She's going to explain every single one to us, which I love.
Yeah. Attacks on free speech and a lack of due process.
Well, we should all be concerned about that. We should all be checking it because it'll come for us eventually, too.
And
I
even
think it's
like,
good to check, but
it just makes me very uneasy. So I'm very, like, maybe you're not, like, you guys go and make breakfast or whatever, or lunch or whatever. I'm paying attention to this because
I love that. And we all should be. Thank you.
Even though it's my administration, I can see
where it could get problematic.
Where it can definitely get problematic.
Yes. So this is what we contribute to the podcast. I will be diligent about watching the wardrobe choices of the administration and make sure that they're acting like adults.
I'm like pulling case law over here trying to understand what's going on.
He's trying to defend people's free speech rights. It's a great balance,
well,
really.
That's what we're here for.
Okay, we have a final segment.
We do. We got some earmarks.
This is our earmark segment where we don't have time to talk about all these things, but we will highlight them because you need to know about them. We're going to go real quick through these and just give you like a one sentence explainer. If you have any questions, drop it in the comments and we'll try and answer them.
Or DM us on our Instagram because we may have already covered it. So
it's so true. Yesterday, X.
My entire life was cyber.
I could not get on X for about 7 minutes. And I may or may not have spoke sternly to my husband about why is Starlink not working? I can't get on X. I need to get on X. And everything else is working. Maybe it's just X. No, it's not. That can't happen. Elon is in charge of it. And it turns out, there was a cyber attack. It was hit by anonymous Sudan via
a DOS attack.
Yes. And it did go offline globally. Elon Musk took to X and said that some of the IPs that were involved were Ukrainian. Everybody went, what?
Which is, there's a lot of speculation about what does that mean?
Yep. Ooh. Yep. And it did. I heard, didn't it take down Rumble too for a little bit?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that's not great because I think even if what was so funny, too, is when I was reporting about it online, I had so many people comment. They're like, Well, doesn't matter to me. I don't use X. X is gross. It's the worst. And I was like, do any of you understand that X is the primary outlet for journalists and independent voices that are trying to
report. And producers that are trying to create content like this.
Yes. And actually, it's important to us. Very important.
Tim Pool was talking about it last night on his IRL show. And he even said that it is our jumping off point for when we are producing stories or looking for stories to cover. Yeah. Like it is, you may not, it is toxic.
You may not, we do it so you don't have to do it, but we need to do it. We need X, and we owe Elon Musk a lot because he bought it and it opened up free speech. He saved that.
A lot of information. I was refreshing.
You know, I texted Mercedes. I'm like, hey, is X down for you too? And I thought I was upset. Mercedes came in all caps. He's like, yeah, and this isn't funny. I'm trying to get the show notes ready for tomorrow. So thank you, Elon, for getting it back up so quickly, or Mercedes may have had a heart attack. Okay, next earmark. Marco Rubio slashes the USAID. He announced, like we just talked about, we referenced it, 83% of the USAID programs have been eliminating. They cited inefficiency and misalignment with U.S. interests. You'll remember when he was in his confirmation hearing, he basically said that there's three objectives for him that Trump gave him. He needs to act in America's best interest, keep America safe, put America's people first. And they found that 83% of these funds were not doing that in one way or another. And then the rest of the programs that still exist will be shifted to the State Department.
And they're focused on actual aid. So anyone that's saying that they're cutting humanitarian aid, that's not true.
No, yeah. Tell them, ask them to cite their sources.
And also, let me just point out that I haven't gone digging into this, but let's just kind of work this thought exercise. If 83% was able to be cut of USAID with the State Department prioritizing humanitarian aid in order to maintain their soft power, that just kind of gives you a picture of how much stuff was being wasted on projects that were not necessarily in the interest of the State Department.
Well, and think about the other agencies that probably have an equal amount of waste. Like, you run that across the board. That is significant. Okay, next earmark.
This
one was fun. It's a fun troll. This was, I think, a little bit of a troll that's really going to be actually beneficial. So you remember that the Democrats had the CBP One app that was Biden had used. Basically, they would let in illegal immigrants into the country. They would be given an app where they could apply for their court case, essentially. And then the app would alert them when they had to come in to be.
And then they would be like flown into the United States.
Well, that was turned off almost immediately once Trump became president. But they have started it up again. And instead of starting it up to notify immigrants when it's time for their asylum case or whatever, they need to appear in court. The CBP One app has now been revamped. And now it's called CBP Home. Okay, to quote, facilitate self-deportation. So basically, the users can declare their intent to leave the U.S. voluntarily in the app, basically as like a safeguard to reduce forced deportations. So basically, they go into the app. I saw a picture of it on X. Did you see it? Where they go and they can click like, one of two things. I am leaving. I promise. Don't come get me.
Or I need help to leave or something like that. Yeah. And so now people are like, why would someone do this? Now, the reason, like Kristi Noem, which is the Secretary of Homeland Security, she said, if you sign up and you self-deport, you will have the opportunity to re-enter the United States legally if you go through the legal process.
But if you don't,
you will then not be allowed to re-enter. If you go and try to re-enter legally, you'll lose your right to re-enter.
Yeah.
So that is the incentive to get people to do it. What's also very interesting is that if they already have the app on their phone, it is automatically updated to CBP One. I'm sorry, CBP Home.
As in go home.
Yeah. ET go home, right? And then, and all of that information, they're using all the information that was already existing in the CBP One app to know who entered the United States
and where they're going
and where they were supposed to be going.
Brilliant.
Via the app.
I want to know who thought it up.
Say it's probably Elon.
I know.
I mean, this is tech support. This is what you want tech support for.
Okay, next earmark. Marco Rubio, my main man, is in Saudi Arabia for Ukraine talks presently. He visited Saudi Arabia. He's talking with Ukrainian officials. Zelensky's not there, but they're exploring peace negotiations with Russia. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salam is hosting, and it's positioning Saudi as a key mediator in this conflict.
Also, I didn't include this, but the Middle East envoy, who is like their main, I forgot his name. Oh my gosh, my brain just shut down. But he is headed to Russia to speak with Putin to also.
These guys are working. They are working.
Yeah.
So that's good.
I don't know. We'll see what's happening.
I mean, hopefully it'll be good. Which leads into the next earmark. Trump continues pause on the Ukraine aid. So there is a freeze that has been maintained on the U.S. military aid and intelligence support to Ukraine, pushing Kyiv towards peace negotiations, kind of like putting the pressure on a little bit. We're not going to give you aid right now. You need to come to the table and discuss with us. Our allies overseas are...
They don't like you.
No,
honestly,
no
look, I want to be... Not to defend the EU or whatever, mm-hmm. but I'm very weary, or I just don't get the negotiation practice here mm-hmm. because the United States or Trump's administration has paused aid to Ukraine. And they have also paused sharing intelligence information with Ukraine. Yeah. But then, meanwhile, Russia hasn't really been getting a ton of pressure until recently. And the concern is that which they are, Russia has been bombing Ukraine significantly mm-hmm. since this has happened.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, it's to push Ukraine to peace talks. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, it doesn't look great.
Yeah. We're going to have to see.
We'll see how this entire situation plays out. And hopefully the other challenge was that Trump did say that even if Zelensky signs the mineral deal, what he really wants is for him to agree to a peace deal.
Yeah. Which would mean concessions on his end and that he has said he is not fond of.
And he said that just signing the mineral deal won't cut it and won't unfreeze the aid. So a lot of pressure on.
Hopefully that these visits to both Saudi Arabia and Russia will yield something. Our last earmark is that there is the whole quote unquote defunding the government, fund the government talk is going to be the chatter you're going to hear in the next week or two. The continuing resolution vote is imminent. It's going to happen anytime. Congress is proposing a full year continuing appropriations act to fund the government through this coming September, which maintains current spending levels. The vote is expected by the end of this week, so like Friday, to avoid the government shutdown. I think it shuts down March 14th at midnight.
Something like that. And then there's like this whole thing of whether or not the continuing resolution like passes a vote like by that point. And then the weekend goes through, because that happens a lot. Like weekend will go through and there'll be like some more negotiations going on. And then come mm-hmm. Monday, you know, it might actually pass. Yeah. Now, here's why this one is unique, because typically a continuing resolution is like for a few months. Like it's just like a kick the can down, like maybe 2 months or something like that. The fact that this one pushes it the remainder of the fiscal year mm-hmm. makes it very different. It's very interesting, by the way, because you're going to hear the Democrats get really upset about this. But when you actually look at the funding numbers, they pretty much actually align with funding during the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. So right now, what the Republicans are doing is they're agreeing to keep the funding numbers basically the same as what the Democrats voted for beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And any kind of, there was these claims of like cuts to veterans and all that's not in there. I went, and this is a continuing resolution that's only 99 pages long.
It's very short.
It's usually like long. Thousands of pages.
1,500
okay?
pages. Yes.
So right now the narrative battle is going to be who's going to be willing to shut down the government. The Democrats are going to say it's the Republicans. The Republicans are going to say it's the Democrats. Yep. Massey's already said that he's not going to vote for it. Now Trump is calling for Massey to be primaried for not wanting to vote for the continuing resolution, which I don't get. There are representatives who are typically, what do you call them? Like they don't want to spend money. Okay. Yeah. For example, one of my personal favorites, who is out of Knoxville, Tennessee, Tim Burchett, he usually votes along with Massey, and he has voted against these continuing resolutions in the past. The goal here, this is what's being pitched, okay? The goal with this continuing resolution is to fund the government for the year long enough so the Republicans can then focus on cutting spending and officially passing legislation to keep these executive orders mm-hmm. that the administration has been doing and codifying them to make sure that all the spending that they're trying to cut is locked down so it then can't be overturned in a future administration.
And Trump is pushing for support on this and basically saying we need time to figure out what the heck is going on and get our house in order, get our finances in order. You need to give us more time. We just got in here 6 weeks ago and we need you to vote yes on this so that we can do due diligence with what we've discovered and kind of get ready for the next step of us fixing this
now,
budget.
Massey sees it as not being enough and he's like, I'm not going to vote for anything. He says,
which
he
is standard.
I mean,
he votes no every single time.
Not surprising. Burchett, to just use it as another example of someone who usually votes against continuing resolutions, but mm-hmm. he's saying that my conversations with the administration mm-hmm. and everything is that it is clear that it is their goal to cut spending and what they need is a little bit of time in order to do that. I mean, like they're already kind of trying to do that. So I believe them. So
we'll find out.
Anyways, we'll find out. So that's it. That
no,
is all.
No,
what did I forget?
One more earmark. Can I
okay.
have one?
Absolutely.
This is just a little weird thing, but you know how I was just really on top of the whole Joe Biden is running the White House when Joe
are you
was
talking
there.
Auto pen?
Yes, I am.
Oh,
yes,
I forgot
am.
About the auto pen.
Because it's we all know that he wasn't running the show, but I don't think we ever will know to what degree, but it came out. The House Oversight Committee has released information basically asking who was the president the last 2 years, which we all have asked, or anybody watching, any honest person has asked. But apparently there was, so in December of 2022, so December 30th, Joe Biden, well, quote unquote, Joe Biden pardoned six criminals. But when the House Oversight Committee was like looking at the documents, it turns out that Joe Biden was vacationing and golfing in the Virgin Islands.
Yeah.
Where he always would go. I mean, he's been there multiple times. But the auto pin on these pardons all is exactly the same. And they all say signed in the city of Washington at a time when he was not in Washington. So it's like, what? So like basically the House Oversight Project found that almost all of the documents that he signed were completely run by Auto Pen's signature. And so the oversight, and you can follow them on X, it's at Oversight PR. Basically, they said, quote, we gathered every document we could find with Biden's signature over the course of his presidency, all used the same Auto Pen signature, except for the announcement that the former president was dropping out of the race last year. And then it shows the Auto Pen signature. And they're basically claiming this is criminal. This is not okay. Who was doing this? If it's an auto pen signature, anybody could be signing any document. And so I just thought that was worth.
Well, it is
interesting.
Now, auto pen has been around since like the 90s. I think it was during Clinton. But the issue here is that typically the auto pen has some kind of tracking that mm-hmm. the president still has authorized the use of it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
The question here is that with the Biden administration, considering the concerns that there are with his cognitive decline and the fact mm-hmm. that he was literally out of the country, and there were multiple occasions where he publicly was told that he signed something and he was asked about it and then he had no knowledge of it.
Yes.
Now the question, did he have no knowledge of it because of his cognitive decline, or did he have no knowledge of it because he didn't authorize and sign it?
Right. I mean, you understand, no one's asking about Trump's auto pin because the man is
in front
of
everybody,
the country, signing everything all the time. This is
Can we also point out that
question?
Like, why was Biden always signing things on a soundstage at his Fisher Price desk? I don't understand. Right. Like, where
were
was
these,
this happening?
Constructed random little mini desks. It was like the little people that my daughters play with. Like, they would just set up these little teeny desks in like the side closet in the White House. It's all very bizarre. I have so many questions. I was all about they needed to declare the 25th Amendment, that I just still go to my grave.
So
bummed about that. But the auto pin, man, I want to be on that committee. Sign me up.
I want to know. Okay, that's it. That's all we got for today's episode of Rivera and Reeves. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. If this is your first time here, welcome. You have found your new favorite podcast. Make sure that you hit that follow button, give us a 5-star rating, and leave us a lovely review because it really helps the podcast grow. And if you want bonus content, community, because by the way, if you're not on Substack, that's where all the cool kids are. First of all, okay?
It really is.
Like, if you like to read, if you like articles, it's not just about politics. It's about all kinds of stuff. Go download that Substack app. And Rachel, every morning, starts a little chat where we kind of talk about, it's like a little therapy session for the community, okay? What's going on in the world? How are you handling it? What are your thoughts? Come and join the conversation. But that is exclusive to paying supporters. Now, if you want to start your own chat, that is open to everyone where you can ask questions. You can do that. But we have an exclusive little everyday paying supporter conversation going on. So please consider becoming a paying supporter where you get access to the community, to bonus content, and you'll get ad-free episodes. All right? Everyone, like, we recently had some new signups. Welcome. We loved that you're here. Thank you so much. Okay?
We appreciate it.
We appreciate it.
Keeps us going.
Okay? Because one day, we will be so big that I won't have to edit this podcast anymore.
please. I feel bad for Mercedes. Because like I said, really what I contribute is the earmarks and she writes them up. I just say them. And then I also talk about, well, let's see. What do I do?
I call you the cruise director, okay?
I'm the PR, I guess, wing of this operation. But Mercedes doing the heavy lifting.
So it's fine. We work. I love it. It works. She left me one time and I would never forgave her for it. Anyways, that's it. That's all we have for today's episode. Thank you so much. We'll see you again on Thursday for another episode of Rivera and Reeves. And here's a reminder that the media is trash and we have no tolerance for it. Okay. Bye.
Bye.